Thanks so much for joining us on this lovely October day. No, just kidding. We're underway here in August. It is Minnesota Law. Steve Thompson here. Tom Schroyer back in studio today. Tom, always great to see you.
It is great to be here, Steve. I'm hoping for some tomatoes still, though.
Yeah, I'm thinking about buying firewood now. I think that would be in order. I've never purchased firewood in August before, but...
It's amazing. And, of course, it's been nice, bright, and sunny, so we've been able to get outdoors on the weekends. Right. That's been fun. And still hoping to get some more rain, of course, and a little bit of summer. So we're here today, though, Steve, with Dave Beek. Dave, welcome back. This is your third time, I believe, on the program.
Thank you, Tom.
And Dave, as our listeners know from before, is a patent lawyer. He's a registered patent lawyer with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office with more than 20 years of experience in representing inventors who are seeking patents and also the holders of patents in terms of enforcing their rights and preventing others from improperly using them. So you work with licensing of patents as well.
That's correct, Tom.
And Dave has... regularly advise clients, in addition, on patent infringement issues, which is really what we're going to be talking about today, although we're going to also talk about patents in general. But really, what are the issues when somebody is accused of infringing, and how should they respond when they face an infringement claim? Dave, that's become a big part of your practice.
Well, that's right. And part of this is that patents really represent valuable rights of patent owners in order to exclude other people from manufacturing, using, selling the subject matter of the patent. And this translates into a lot of money in a lot of cases, including in our own community. Just earlier this week, Medtronic, for example, paid $400 million to Abbott Laboratories to settle some worldwide litigation involving Medtronic's Endeavor heart stent. Boston Scientific and Medtronic paid about $600 million to Johnson & Johnson back in 2003. Even way back in 1992, 3M in our community collected $129 million for one of their patents from Johnson & Johnson. So the point is that there's a lot of money that is at risk in riding on these patents, and patent owners are going to be very ready to enforce their rights. And so therefore, it really behooves companies and individuals to proactively plan ahead to try to avoid, to the extent they can, infringing other people's patents.
Well, and a lot of jobs here are represented by these high-tech industries that we have located here, everything from Medtronic and Boston Scientific to 3M and Honeywell and other concerns. And, of course, if their intellectual property can't be protected by a patent, those jobs could be at jeopardy.
Well, that's right. And you know, that's really the bedrock of the patent system, both in the U.S. and elsewhere in the world. A lot of people don't realize this is actually a right that's mentioned in our own United States Constitution. And assuming that the patent was properly granted by the patent office, it provides a valuable incentive for these kinds of inventive activities that entail a lot of technical and commercial risk. If you didn't have a patent system, there really wouldn't be the incentive for people to go out and develop things if their competitors could just simply copy what they do once it becomes successful.
And I know that you mentioned here a moment ago the local interest or orientation on patent law, but you also practice worldwide now with patent registrations.
Well, that's right. We're blessed to have a number of clients who have the kinds of products that really have commercial resonance all around the world. And so they obviously are very, very interested in protecting their rights not only in the United States but also in Canada, Mexico, Europe, Japan, and the Far East. I've been getting a lot of patent applications recently in places like South Africa and South America that, 10 years ago I never really would have seen. And so I think this suggests that patents and intellectual property in general has become a very, very worldwide issue and right. I know one study determined that 85% of the assets of Standard & Poor's 500 corporations are intellectual property as opposed to bricks and mortar and plants. So, I mean, we've come a very, very long ways from industrial America back in the early 1900s.
So we really are in an information technology society here, and our our country's continued success is really tied closely to not only the ability to keep generating new ideas, but also to protect and enforce them both here and abroad.
That's correct.
Dave, when we talk about enforcing patents abroad, how tough is that, though? Are there teeth in the laws that apply overseas or that help an American company enforce a patent when they've had it issued in America and then cross-register it with some other country?
Well, Tom, as in a lot of things in the legal world, it depends. There are many parts of the world like, Europe, the countries like Japan in the Far East, Canada, which have patent systems and courts ready to enforce patents that are similar to our own. China, on the other hand, has a patent system that the law looks very, very much like our United States law. In fact, I believe it's even copied almost verbatim from our law. They're in the process of developing a court system which will really reliably enforce those laws. And, I think that's an exercise that's in progress.
One of the things we hear about when it comes to China is that Chinese manufacturer is doing bootleg things, that they're manufacturing items, goods, whatever, to look like a product that's maybe manufactured under or in the United States. Does that fall under this as well? I mean, the trademark infringements or manufacturing processes that are maybe copied overseas, do those fall under this?
Well, it certainly would, Steve, under this broad umbrella mm-hmm. of intellectual property. When you talk about bootleg goods, in a lot of cases you're talking about violations of copyrights because the copyright is going to protect the owner's particular visual appearance of the good. A copyright does not protect the invention. That's what a patent does. Now, we do have in the United States something called the International ITC, which is a litigation proceeding on an extremely fast track that you can use in order to prevent those goods that were made in China in such a manner that they would infringe once they're imported in the U.S. to be able to stop them right at the border. Nice. And prevent them from actually coming into our country. And that's a very, very powerful tool for companies that own these patents because instead of a litigation proceeding that might take years, an ITC proceeding can be wrapped up in a matter of months. And the patent owner can have its whole infringement case put together ahead of time, drop it on the party that's improperly importing the infringing goods, and that party will be very hard-pressed to really scramble fast enough to be able to defend itself.
But still, that may be and is good for the United States enforcement. But what about enforcing against these kinds of knockoffs that we hear coming out of China in other countries? If a U.S. company wants to enforce its patents, say, in India against a Chinese bootleg product or knockoff?
Well, I guess the first thing to understand, Tom, is that a U.S. patent is only going to have effect in the United States. So you can prevent somebody from manufacturing, using, selling that product in the United States, and you can also prevent them from importing that product into the United States. That's that ITC action I was just talking about. In order to have a right to enforce in China or India, you actually have to get an equivalent patent issued in China and India. And, they have patent systems in those countries. We have clients who are going out and getting those kinds of patents. And then you would have to actually enforce that in a court proceeding in those countries. And, I don't want to belittle those countries by saying that their legal systems are worse than ours. Sometimes they're just a little different than ours.
We have more on the way. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer is our host. Dave Beek joining us in studio today. Once again, We're talking patents today, and once again, how you can avoid infringing on another's patent. That in the spotlight today. The phone number is on the program if you have a question or a comment for Tom or Dave. The phone number is 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. You can also text the studio as well at 81807. That service powered, as always, by Wellington Window and Door Company. We have more coming up in a moment.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
How did you become a lawyer? Did you know the Minnesota rules for admission to practice law require that a person attend an accredited law school and pass a two-day bar examination?
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
Thanks so much for joining us. It is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett, available online at moss-barnett.com. The program comes your way each and every Saturday between noon and 1 o'clock. Tom Schreuer is our host in studio today. Great to have Tom back. Dave Beek joining us in studio. Patents in the spotlight again. Always a very popular topic.
Yes, Steve, it really has been popular. And, of course, we do invite our listeners to call or text in with any questions or comments for Dave Beek, who is a registered patent attorney with more than 20 years' experience and is an integral member to the Moss and Barnett Intellectual Property Practice Group. We've had from that group Marcia Stolt on the program before to talk about trademarks, her specialty area, and Dave works in that area in copyrights as well as predominantly, I would say, patent law.
That's right, Tom.
Dave, we are talking about infringing on a patent, but first maybe we give a little background just to make sure everybody's on the same page here in terms of what is a patent. And, of course, at a broad conceptual level, a patent is a grant by the government of a legal monopoly to control the making and sale of an idea or the use of an idea, or if an inventor doesn't want to do that, they at least can prevent others from using that idea for the life of the patent.
Well, that's right, Tom, and you know, we try to avoid the word monopoly because of the pejorative nature of that term, but it's a right that's given by the government to someone by virtue of having invented something new, and it could be a product, it could be a process, it could be a way of using a product that is sufficiently new and what we call non-obvious over everything that's been done previously that it's worthy of this special protection. And but at the same time, a patent right isn't unlimited. It's going to be limited in scope by what we call the claims, which are the numbered paragraphs that in a U.S. patent appears at the end of the document. And that's through a negotiation process with the examiner at the patent office, the scope of the patent right that you can enforce, and only that.
So a claim really is a description of how the invention works.
No, a claim is a description of the exclusive, the extent of the exclusive right that you have to prevent somebody else from practicing a particular process or a particular product. Because a patent doesn't give you the affirmative right to practice your invention. Someone else could have a pre-existing patent that maybe was broader in scope, and you'd have to make sure that you didn't infringe their patents for their claimed inventions, even while you have a narrower claim on your invention. And that's partly what leads to this topic this morning of the need to proactively make sure that you aren't infringing other people's patents.
All right. So a person is granted a patent that's given by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
That's correct.
And that follows a lengthy process usually of submitting applications, describing the invention and showing how it works, and negotiating the scope of the patent that you call these claims.
That's right. Think of it kind of like a surveyor with a piece of land. And a surveyor is going to come up with a description of the precise boundaries of that piece of land. It could be your backyard, for instance. A claim and a patent operates in the same way and says this is the boundary around this product, that if you're inside the claim, you can't do that. If you're outside of the claim, then you're okay because you're not practicing what's in the patent.
Now, when a patent has been granted, is that the end of the story? Is that, for is that so to speak, the key to the highway, and that's the end of the story? Or are there issues potentially lurking in the patent even after it's been granted by the patent office in terms of whether it can be used or enforced?
Well, you know, there's never anything that's absolutely final, Tom. Certainly, when you look at a patent document, and, you know, companies have skilled researchers and managers who look at these things every day. It's part of what they do in executing their business plan. You can look at the literal language, the words in the claims, and you can come then to a viewpoint of what you think that exclusive right in the claim is. A lot of times, though, it's not that simple, because you got to look at it within the context of the larger document. The larger document may define certain terms in a way that they're actually a little narrower than you or I just on the street might use them. So the claim might actually be a little narrower than it first appears. We also have something called the prosecution file history, which is the recorded record of all the written correspondence and the oral communications that go back and forth between the inventor through his attorney and the examiner, with the inventor typically trying to explain why his invention is different from what has happened before, what we call the prior art. That can also be used in order to narrow the interpreted language of those claims. You can't, for instance, make an argument to an examiner to diminish the nature of the prior art to get your claim allowed, but then turn around and totally disregard that when you want to enforce your right against somebody else.
So looking down the road, when we're thinking about enforcing a patent against infringement by somebody else, we have to be, I'm sure, very careful about how we phrase and address these issues, both in talking to the patent office and in terms of what actually is written up in these claims.
That's right. There's a lot of care and precision that goes in not only to the language of the claims, but also the arguments that are made to the examiner. And then you also always have lurking in the background this issue of prior art, which could be previous patents by others. It could be scientific journal articles. It could be commercial usages. This is all prior art. And you need to make sure that your claim is valid.
We have more on this coming up on Minnesota Law, following the news and weather here on 830 WCCO. Welcome back. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Each and every Saturday between noon and 1 o'clock, you can find Moss and Barnett online at moss-barnett.com. Tom Schreuer, our host, Dave Beacon Studio, patents in the spotlight again. It's Dave's third appearance on the program. By the way, the number on the show, 651-989-9226, or toll-free, 1-866-989-9226. If you have questions about patents, maybe you have an idea, and how do you go about getting a patent on that idea or finding out if a patent already exists? Maybe someone has come up with that idea first. How do you find out about that? If you have a question for Tom and Dave, by all means, call the program. We go to the lines now. Bill in Minneapolis is waiting. Bill, you're on Minnesota Law. Hello.
Good morning, or afternoon. I have a question about copywriting engineering type drawings. I am an engineer and land planner, and when the housing market was good, we were working with a project in Wisconsin that we put together drawings, and then as the economy turned, the developer went bankrupt. The project never got built. But I know that they're still hopeful that somebody will come in and buy the property and develop it as, you know, sort of in keeping with the drawings that we prepared. And I'm wondering if it's possible to copyright those drawings. I did not get paid for any of our work, so that was, you know, sort of the reason for, I guess, trying to protect my interests there.
Certainly, Bill, thanks for the question. And yes, engineering drawings or architectural drawings are things that are copyrighted. What you would be protecting there would be the overall visual appearance of, as did you say this was a house that was designed? And that represents a valuable intellectual property asset. You know, assuming that there is something that is sufficiently distinct.
Well, in
the design.
Case, it was actually a development, a residential development. So we designed the roads and where the homes would go, and you know, the the stormwater ponds and those kinds of things.
Oh, okay. Okay, I maybe didn't hear the very beginning of what you were describing. You know, it strikes me, Bill, that you're getting a little bit closer there to something that is very functional. You know, where a road would go relative to a storm drain that, you tell me, might be similar as opposed to dissimilar to how other people would design a storm drain relative to plots of land along a road?
I think my question would be, you know, we designed this. There was some surveying done, but the roads were never, you know, completed and the homes were never built. But if the next guy comes in and says, boy, they've done a lot of work for us, let's put the roads where he showed them and let's, you know, we can still get 50 home sites. And, you know, so they basically use our plans to complete the project. You know, I mean, obviously they're using our plan, and I guess the question is, if they make minor changes, would we still be in, you know, able to protect our drawings? I mean, they could easily just say, well, we're not going to use your plans. We're going to have somebody else come in and redesign it, and it won't look at all like your design.
Yeah, you know, Bill, there's a lot of issues involved in your question. I would say as a general matter that you may have some copyright protection which vests just the moment you create the work. So you don't actually have to register something at the federal level to have a copyright protection. But you may also have a legal claim through contract or otherwise, something we call quantum merit, to protect the value of what you designed and developed and prevent somebody else from just pirating it. So, you know, an attorney would certainly be able to help you get through those issues. I think you may have some ways you can go to in order to protect your rights.
Yeah, certainly it seemed to me, and I've worked on litigation and around this issue, a lot depends on the contract, if any, that Bill and his colleagues entered into with the developer and what rights they may have retained in this work product that they developed. But, of course, as always, we can't give specific legal advice, so really Bill will have to go see a lawyer to find out the answer that really fits his situation.
Guys, what about that boundary between copyright and patents? You know, certain ideas would fit under patent law. Other ideas or concepts would be copyrighted. Where's that boundary, and what's the difference between the two?
Well, Steve, the patents and copyrights protect two different aspects of a product. A patent is going to protect the way the product functions, I guess is maybe the simplest way I can put it. And so it will prevent somebody else from copying that product or making something that functions in a very substantially similar manner. A copyright, on the other hand, is going to protect the mode of expressing a certain visual aspect of the product. You know, we think of copyrights as existing within the realm of literature and movies and music, but copyrights can also exist within the realm of products and industrial products. But through a copyright, you can only protect that way of expressing the idea. Someone else could come along, express it in a different way, have a product that bears some, you know, otherwise some similarities, and you can't prevent them from doing that. So that's why copyrights and patents can really provide two different cooperative layers of protection that can make it harder for someone else to copy.
All right, we go to Dennis next in Becker. Dennis, you're on Minnesota Law. Hello.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, and I probably have several, but I'll ask first, how do you go about doing a patent search?
Dennis, good question. And these patent searches can be very, very valuable for finding out what other people have out there. The patent office has a website that you can tap into, which will have a computerized record of all of their, you know, 7 million plus patents that have issued over the years. Now, that's kind of an overwhelming exercise to look through 7 million patents, and believe me, no one does that. The patents are classified according to a government system with a whole bunch of indexes, so depending upon the area of the technology, the characteristics of the product. You could go through that catalog and figure out which classes and subclasses, and you could narrow your search in that manner. You can also use keyword searches, because these are computerized records after all, in order to try to narrow your search inquiry. But of course, that's also dependent upon using the right words. Quite frankly, what I do is I use a skilled searcher in Washington, D.C., to do it for me. These searchers, in many cases, are former examiners themselves, so they're very, very familiar with the classification scheme and where the patent office would organize this prior art. In a lot of cases, because they're former examiners, they have the luxury of actually being able to go in and talk to a current examiner and say, hey, I'm looking at for prior art that does X, Y, and Z, where else would you suggest that I go and look? That's a question that an examiner might not answer if I asked it. So through those different avenues, Dennis, you can certainly come up with a pretty darn good search and search results for other people's patents.
And I would assume it's a great idea for the mom-and-pop business, an individual inventor, a tinkerer, or even medium-sized and large companies, if they've come up with that new idea. That's maybe the first thing you want to do.
Well, that's right, Steve, because, you know, when we talk about patents, we always start out by thinking, how am I going to protect my invention and prevent other people from practicing it? And that's very valuable. But just as important, you want to make sure that you aren't infringing somebody else's patent. And one of the important things to understand is that in our patent system, you don't actually have to have actual knowledge of someone else's patent. You don't have to have any kind of bad intent to actually go out and infringe somebody else's patent to be an infringer. This is what we call absolute liability. So the question really becomes, when you're putting a product out there in the commercial marketplace and making money, are you inside of that claim or outside of it? Is that patent claim and the patent valid over the prior art, or invalid? Because these patent examiners work very hard to do their job, but they're fallible. They don't always know of all the prior art out there. And so, you know, the first step, unless you just happen to stumble across one of these patents, in many cases may be to go out and do that kind of search that you're talking about, Steve, to get a collection of patents that then you want to take a harder look at yourself and with the assistance of counsel.
As you were saying, Dave, infringing a patent is not a, as it were, a crime of intent. You don't have to even know that the patent exists in order to be infringing and be sued for infringement.
That's right. And you know, that may seem unjust, but that's the system. And once you get sued, then you've got to deal with the litigation.
What are the remedies if somebody is a patent holder and they have been victimized by somebody else infringing their patent? What can be the outcome?
You mean the remedy for the patent holder?
Right.
Well, first of all, they can try to collect damages for the infringing activity that's already occurred, and that could be in the form of a reasonable royalty that would be determined by the court, or under certain circumstances, it could be in the form of lost profits. So the infringer could be forced to cough up all the profits that it made. And the patent holder is also allowed to reach back 6 years to collect. So just because you know somebody else out there has a patent, it's not a good idea to just kind of hang out and do nothing for 6 years and hope that they don't notice, because they may actually be able to reach back 6 years and get all the profits that you improperly got because of the infringement. And patents are also presumed to be valid by virtue of the fact that they were actually examined and issued by the U.S. Patent Office. So, you know, the patent holder is typically going to have the whip hand once a litigation has commenced, because they've got their case all lined up. They've done their analysis. They understand why they think that the infringer infringes. And, of course, they're going to do everything possible to make sure that their patent claims are valid.
We have more on the way. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Saturdays between noon and 1 o'clock, Moss and Barnett, available online at moss-barnett.com. We'll continue with Dave Beek and our host, Tom Schroyer, in a moment here on 830-WCCO.
This is Sidebar on Minnesota Law.
You can't handle the truth.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Two youths.
Are you sure this is legal?
You think you know every trick in the book, and they come up with another one.
Moss and Barnett, excellence in the community. Did you know every year, Moss and Barnett awards the Paul Van Valkenburg Award for Distinguished Community Service to one of its employees? Past winners include Tom Keller, Chuck Parsons, Connie Schofield, Adrian Summerfield, Kevin Bush, and Cheryl Riggs.
Minnesota Law is presented by Moss and Barnett and returns in a moment on News Radio 830 WCCO.
Welcome back. Final segment of Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Remember, Minnesota Law, each Saturday beginning at noon right here on News Radio 830 WCCO. Great to have Tom Schroyer back in studio today. And always great to see Dave Beek in studio. And we talk about patents, a lot of great calls, a lot of great comments. And it's one of those programs where we could talk for another hour or two easily. There's a lot there.
We are truly just scratching the surface. And, of course, we will have Dave back in the future for more discussion of patent law. And, Dave, our emphasis today has been on patent infringement, and we've been talking about some of the remedies, and you were talking about the ability to look back 7 years, 6 years, excuse me, for recovery of lost profits or damages, and that can be measured as a royalty. But what about going forward? Can a patent holder enforce the patent going forward as well?
Yes. I mean, you know, once the patent holder has won the litigation, they are going to typically receive an injunction against the infringer infringing in the future. After all, otherwise there'd be no real remedy under the litigation. So that's going to then put the infringer in a very tough spot, because it really is going to have to stop manufacturing, stop selling the infringing product or process, and you know, could just entirely discontinue an entire business line. So a lot of times there will then be something worked out between the patent holder and the infringer, where the infringer receives some sort of licensed right going forward, pays money for that, of course, but is able to stay in business that way. Now, of course, the patent holder isn't obligated to grant that licensed right, and that's one of the things, again, that a company or an individual has to take in mind in, you know, proactively addressing or ignoring at their peril these kinds of infringement issues before they're sued, because it's been my experience in a lot of cases these issues can be resolved much more amicably before a litigation is filed rather than after a litigation is filed.
So when somebody's been put on notice of an infringement claim against them, Dave, you mentioned that it's important for them to take the matter seriously and be proactive. What kinds of things should they be thinking about and doing?
Well, and Tom, I just want to indicate this is actually even backs up a step from that. Just simply discovering the existence of someone else's patent that seems to cover your product or process places you under a legal duty to investigate in good faith and to address that issue before you just put your product on the market or you continue to sell your product on the marketplace. So you don't actually have to wait to actually get sued for this to be relevant or pertinent. If you don't investigate it in good faith, then you can be subject to what's called willful infringement. So not only if you lose that subsequent suit would you be an infringer, but if you're found to be a willful infringer, the judge could treble the damages, triple them, which can be really a very, very substantial hit. And so what happens in my patent field is that in a lot of cases the company or the individual will come to a patent attorney like me and say, you know, I've got this third-party patent that I've discovered that I'm concerned about. I want you to investigate and see if you can determine a good faith legal argument for why I don't infringe, or absent that, why the patent is actually invalid. And then I will rely upon your legal advice in going forward with my commercial business, my commercial practices. And in almost all cases, Tom, assuming that that analysis performed by that counsel was competently done, that is going to save the company from this willful infringement, which is kind of the ultimate boogeyman.
What are some of the issues that you look at when you're thinking about this kind of a patent opinion, an attorney's opinion? What kinds of issues come up in terms of whether the patent is valid or invalid or whether or not there's been an infringement?
Well, you know, the attorney, first of all, as the person seeking the opinion, you're going to want to put all the relevant facts in the hands of your attorney so that he or she can perform a good faith and thorough analysis. The attorney is going to look at the patent and look at those claims that we talked about earlier in our hour here. The attorney, though, through his or her training, is also, though, going to be able to look at the rest of the patent document, to look at that prosecution file history that we talked about earlier, which is the record of everything that transpired between the inventor and the patent office leading up to the issuance of the patent. We'll oftentimes be able to skillfully marshal those additional facts to come up with a proper interpretation of the scope of that claim, in many cases narrower than maybe the company originally thought that they were subject to. Then they will compare the specific product or process against that interpreted scope of the claim to determine, is it inside that interpreted claim or is it outside of that interpreted claim? Now, if it's outside of the interpreted claim, then an attorney like me can provide an opinion of non-infringement saying there's no infringement because of these reasons.
Outstanding. We're just about out of time. And if people have more questions, how do they contact you, Dave?
I've been in this racket, so to speak, for more than 20 years. So I would be more than happy to talk to anybody further who has any questions. I can be contacted at Moss & Barnett, and my phone number is 612-877-5299, and I'd be happy to follow up with anybody in our audience on any questions they might have.
Or they can email you through our website.
They can also email me through our website, correct.
And next week, Tom?
Next week we'll be back to talk with Nancy Kiskus about estate planning, estate taxes. We're going to see a roller coaster ride of estate tax law changes over the next 18 months. That should be a fascinating show.
That's coming up here on Minnesota Law on 830 WCCO.